Yeah, that's it. We missing something?
That's okay. Rachel is sick, so. Okay, so we are very happy to have Ben Weinkopf from UC San Diego. He will talk about carriage flow on Heisenberg surfaces.
That's very good. Thanks. Well, it's a pleasure to be here. Thank you for the invitation. Let me, so I'm going to talk about the Cato-Ricci flow on a class of surfaces called the Herzberg surfaces. Let me begin with a brief outline of what I want to talk about. So let me begin with some background on Cayley geometry and the Cayley-Ricci flow, and then I want to introduce these Herzberg surfaces and describe our results on the Cayley-Ricci flow, and then I want to talk a little bit about the higher dimensional analog, and then I want to say a little bit more precisely how we go about this, and to do that I want to talk about something called the Calabi ansatz, and then finally I want to mention some estimates. So this is a brief outline of what I want to talk about, and let me begin with the background. Well, perhaps before I do that, maybe I'll say that this is joint work with Jan Song, who's at Rutgers. So to begin with, some background on the setup of Cayley geometry that we're looking at. So we're looking here at compact Cayley manifolds. So we're always going to have a compact Cayley manifold, which I'm usually going to call M, and it's going to have complex dimension n. In fact, it'll mostly have complex dimension 2. But let's say it has complex dimension n. And by that I mean that we have a Hermitian metric. So we have this Hermitian metric, which locally is just this positive definite Hermitian matrix. We have this 1-1 tensor, which is locally positive definite Hermitian matrix, and from that Hermitian metric, that tensor, I can form a 1-1 form. If I put a square root of minus 1, it's a real 1-1 form, and I call that omega naught. So this is my omega naught. It's a 1-1 form associated to a metric G, and the Cayley condition is that d omega naught is 0. And that gives a first order condition on this tensor G naught. So that's so we have a Cayley manifold, and a basic motivating question, which is still open, is and goes back to the 1950s at least, is the following question, and that is, Does there exist a Cayley metric on a compact Cayley manifold with Ricci curvature equal to constant? So does there exist a Cayley metric, let me call it omega, and let me say it's in the same cohomology class as omega naught. So omega naught is, of course, this closed 1-1 form, so it defines a cohomology class. And so this is an element of H11, that is, the closed real 1-1 forms questioned out by the exact 1-1 forms. So does there exist a Cayley metric with the Ricci curvature of that metric equal to a constant times the Ricci curvature, times the metric? Does there exist a metric omega with Ricci curvature is a constant times omega? And here lambda is just, you could normalize it, so it's either minus 1, 0, or 1. So this is a basic question, and it's still, in general, unknown. So that's one question we ask, and the second question we ask, and this is a more recent question. This is, as I said, this goes back to the 50s. This one, only to the 80s, and that is, does the Cayley-Ritchie flow? So this is the Ritchie flow, where you start off with a Cayley metric, and the Ritchie flow preserves the Cayley condition. So the Ritchie and you can write it as follows: the Cayley-Ritchie flow, which is the ddt of omega, is minus the Ritchie curvature of omega. And usually we normalize it. So this is in fact the normalized Cayley-Ritchie flow. So this is the Ritchie flow. Simply, you evolve the metric by minus the Ritchie curvature, and this is just the usual Ritchie flow, where you start with a Cayley metric. So I'll start with omega zero equal to this omega naught. But then we normalize it, which involves just rescaling in time, where you add lambda times omega. And that way, if we normalize it, you can see that a stationary solution would then solve this equation. The Ritchie of omega is lambda omega. So then the second question is, does the Cayley-Ritchie flow converge to a Cayley-Einstein metric? So this is called the Cayley-Einstein equation, Cayley-Einstein equation. So does this converge to a Cayley-Einstein metric? So those are two basic questions. And let me give a little bit of history behind this. So what's known? Well, first of all, let me point out that there's a rather simple necessary condition for the existence of a Cayley-Einstein metric, and that comes from the first Chern class of the manifold. So the first Chern class of the manifold is, well, let me define it in a rather simple way. You can define the first Chern class of a compact Cayley manifold simply as being the cohomology class given by the Ritchie curvature of any fixed Cayley metric, omega naught. So let's remember that the Ritchie curvature of omega naught is simply minus, so the Ritchie curvature in the Cayley case is given by a very simple formula. It's just given by, you take the log of the determinant at G naught, you take dd bar of that, and minus dd bar of the log of the determinant of G naught. You can see that this is closed just because locally it looks like d of something. Notice it's not exact, because this is not a globally defined function. So it's not exact, but it's a closed 1-1 form, so it defines an element of cohomology. Now the point is that this first Chern class is independent of the choice of metric. You can see that from the formula, because this is a volume form. So if I was to change the metric, it doesn't matter what class, just take any other Cayley metric, it would still give me a volume form. And so the difference would simply be multiplication by a positive function, e to the f. And then when you take minus dd bar log, you would just, the difference would simply be dd bar of a function f. And so the cohomology class would be the same, because those two 1-1 forms would just differ by dd bar of a function. Okay, so an obvious condition. So if there exists Cayley-Einstein, we need that either C1 is 0, or negative, or positive. That is, it has to have a negative representative, a 0 representative, or a positive representative. And that's because if you satisfy that equation, then you have lambda omega inside the first Chern class. So let me just briefly say something about each of these cases. So in the case C1 negative, which it turns out to be the easier case, this is the case where lambda is minus 1. That's the case where you'd have minus omega in the first Chern class. So in this case, shown by Yao and Oban, independently in the 1970s, that there exists a unique Cayley-Einstein metric omega in minus C1 of M. So you have to so C1 of M is minus C1 of M is positive. In other words, minus C1 of M admits a positive representative. So that's for the question number one. But indeed, there does exist a K-line symmetry, but it has to be in that class. Number two, does the K-Lorici flow converge? And the answer is yes, again. And this was shown by White on South. So indeed, there exists a K-line symmetric, and the K-Lorici flow converges to it. As long as you start with your initial metric in minus C1 of M, then you'll converge to it. So in the case, the next case is the case C1 of M is 0, which corresponds to lambda is 0. And in this case, for number 1, again, the answer is yes, and this was shown by Yao. And in this case, if C1 is 0, lambda is 0, notice that there's actually no cohomological condition on omega, because this just is just 0. So there's no cohomological condition on omega, and in fact that there exists a unique Kähler-Einstein metric in every Kähler class. So each Kähler class admits a unique one. Whereas in this case, it was only you have to be in this particular class, otherwise it doesn't make sense. And secondly, it was shown by Huaidong Cao that the answer is yes. If you start with any Kähler metric, you'll converge to the Kähler-Einstein metric, which in this case would be Ricci flat, in that cohomology class. Okay. The third case is the most interesting and the hardest, and it's still open. So the case C1 positive. So the question one, does there exist a Kähler-Einstein metric? Well, the answer is in general, no. So in general, there are obstructions. If you have a manifold C1 positive, it does not mean that there will always exist a Kähler-Einstein metric. In general, there are obstructions. And there are conjectures on when there should exist a Kähler-Einstein metric. And the conjecture goes back to Yao. It was made in the 1980s. And that conjecture has been refined recently by Tian and Donaldson. So in general, no. On the other hand, we can say something about number two. And we can say the following. And this is more recent work due to Perelman. Well, Perelman never wrote this down. It was written down by... So Tian and Zhu gave a proof that exists. If there exists a Kähler-Einstein metric, then the Kähler-Ricci flow converges to it. So if there exists Kähler-Einstein, I should be a bit more precise. If there exists a Kähler-Einstein metric, then the Kähler-Ricci flow converges to a Kähler-Einstein metric. I had to be a little bit careful because it turns out in this case C1 positive, you don't have uniqueness. In these two cases, you have uniqueness. Here, you only have uniqueness up to biholomorphisms. So if there exists a Kähler-Einstein metric, then the Kähler-Ricci flow will converge to a Kähler-Einstein metric. You don't necessarily know which one. So I want to, before I move on to the second thing, which is on the Herzberg surfaces, I want to ask another question, which is more recently one of great interest. So this is the background, and this is... Most of this work is quite old now. The next question I want to ask is, if there does not exist a Kähler-Einstein metric, what happens to the Kähler-Ricci flow? What happens to the Kähler-Ricci flow? And does it... The question is, does it somehow find... Does it find the best metric? And another question you might ask is, does it somehow simplify the manifold? Does the flow simplify or break up the manifold? Does it simplify or break up the manifold? And this is a similar... I guess you can think of this as a kind of complex analog of the Ricci flow in three dimensions, where we saw, or at least we, if it's correct, which we all hope is correct, Perelman showed that the Ricci flow geometrizes three manifolds, proving that and uses the Ricci flow to break up the manifold into pieces and prove the geometrization conjecture. So you can think of this question as somehow being a kind of complex analog of that. Does the Ricci flow do something similar in the case of complex manifolds? Well, there's some. I want to mention some work on that. So first of all, there's some work in the case. So I want to mention some work in the case where C1 of M is not negative, but less than or equal to zero in some sense. So there's been some work on this. The first case is the case where the canonical bundle is big in F. So let me explain in a second what I mean by this. So this is the canonical bundle of the manifold. If this is bigger than F, so let me recall that the first Chern class you can think of as being minus the first Chern class of the canonical bundle. So the canonical bundle is the holomorphic line bundle on M, whose transition functions are simply the determinant of the coordinate change. And one condition is that Km is big in F. Well, actually, you can write down this explicitly in terms of Ricci curvature. This simply means to say that it's big means that if you take minus the Ricci curvature of any metric, it doesn't matter, take that closed 1-1 form, raise it to the power n, that has to be positive. So that's what it means for Kn to be big. It just means that this is true, and that would be independent of the choice of metric, that integral. What does it mean to be nef? It means that if you take the integral of minus the Ricci curvature of omega 0, you integrate over a complex curve, this is non-negative for all curves C. So you can think of this as saying, well, it's not quite as strong as saying that the Ricci curvature is negative. If the Ricci curvature was negative, then this would clearly be true, each of these things. In this case, it's a kind of non-negativity of the Ricci, non-positivity of the Ricci curvature. So in this case, then the Cayley-Ricci flow exists for all time, and converges to a singular Cayley-Einstein metric. To a singular Cayley-Einstein metric outside. Which is smooth outside a divisor. Outside a hypersurface. So you get a kind of singular, I'm not going to go into detail, you get a singular Cayley-Einstein metric, which is pretty close to being what you want. It's pretty close to being a Cayley-Einstein metric. It's singular, but it's only singular along a divisor, along a hypersurface, and it's smooth everywhere else. So this is due to Tsuji, who proved this in the 80s, and his result was refined and improved upon by Tian and his student Zhang. Okay, so finally, I want to mention one more result before I go on to the Hertzsprung surfaces, and that is the case of if you take Km, let me just mention this briefly, is nef, so it also has this property that you have this kind of non-negativity, non-positivity of Ricci curvature. But also you have the Kodaira dimension. So in this case, I want to take the complex dimension to be 2, and I want to take the Kodaira dimension of M to be equal to 1. And what that means is that if you take the dimension of the space of holomorphic sections of the canonical bundle raised to a high power, say capital N, then asymptotically this is like capital M, which says that you have a lot of holomorphic sections, but not too many. In the case where it's big, then you have a lot of holomorphic sections. You have, in fact, N squared. You'll get, in dimension 2, you get N squared. And in Kodaira dimension 1 means you only get N, asymptotically. So this is as N goes to infinity. What this means explicitly is that the manifold M is an elliptic vibration over a curve, sigma, and the fibers are elliptic curves, and what happens is that the Cayley-Ritchie flow exists for all time and converges in a weak sense to a what they call generalized Cayley-Einstein metric on the base, on sigma. And this is due to Song and Tian. And what this means is that it's a kind of Cayley-Einstein metric on the base, but plus some extra term which remembers the elliptic vibration. So this is some other work, which is also fits into this sort of category of C1 less than equal to zero.
Could I ask you a question?
Yeah.
If I write this down as a Weierstrass vibration, does this mean I get like everywhere a metric except at the points where the Weierstrass where the vibration degenerates?
Yeah, you'll get singular points where the non-generic.
And these are the only points where the metric is non-defined.
I don't know the precise result here, but it will be smooth outside those points.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. And otherwise, it'll be a 1-1 current.
If I do that for a K3, let's say on the comma K3, is that exactly the flat torus metric I would get outside the singularities?
In that case, it's not clear to me what happens. I mean, the thing with the K3, then you have a Calabi-Yau manifold, so you will just get actually convergence using this result.
All right.
But it's, no, I mean, I think that certainly there are similar kinds of things you'd expect in that case. Okay, let me move on now to the result I want to talk about, which is a different type, but along these kinds of lines. So now I want to talk about a class of surfaces. So this is a family of surfaces parametrized by natural numbers. And these are two complex dimensional surfaces, and they're rational surfaces. That is, they're birational to P2, and they don't have their first Chern class in general doesn't have a sign. So most of them have indefinite first Chern class. So let me tell you what these manifolds are, and I'll describe what we can say about the Cayley-Ritchie flow on these surfaces. So MK is, well, what is it? It turns out to be a P1 bundle over P1. So let me explain what that is. You take this is a rank 2 vector bundle over P1. So this is a rank 2 vector bundle over P1. And let me explain the notation. The H here is the hyperplane bundle. That is, it's the line bundle associated to just the hyperplane in P1, say Z1 is 0. The sections of H would be homogeneous polynomials of degree 1. If you take H to the K, the sections of this line bundle would be homogeneous polynomials of degree K. And when I arrive C in the subscript P1, I just mean the trivial bundle. So this is just a trivial line bundle. So then I'm considering the vector bundle, you just take the direct sum of these two, and you get a rank 2 vector bundle over P1, and then I projectivize the fibers, and that gives me a P1 bundle. So this gives me a P1 bundle over P1. So it looks locally like P1 cross P1. And this turns out to be an important class of surfaces. In fact, so as I said, they're rational surfaces. They turn out to be birational to P2. And in fact, it turns out that all rational surfaces are blow-ups of either P2 or one of these Herzebruch surfaces. So all rational surfaces can be attained by blowing up points on M or P2. Where by blowing up, I mean, in the algebraic sense, that you replace a point by a P1, which is all the directions through that point. let me say something about some examples. So if you take, let me say something about the low numbers. So if you take k is 0, you get a rather simple manifold, because in this case, h to the 0 is just going to be the trivial line bundle. And so this is just going to be the trivial, it's going to be a trivial rank 2 vector bundle. And when you projectivize it, you're just going to get p1 cross p1. So in the case k is 0, you're just going to get p1 cross p1. And in fact, we're going to ignore this case, because it turns out none of what we do is going to work in the case k is 0. And this case has been considered by lots of other people anyway. The case k equals 1 is interesting. It turns out to be p2. This can be identified with p2 blown up at one point. So you replace one point of p2 by a rational curve. The directions through that point. So k equals 1 turns out to be exactly p2 blown up at one point. And these two examples both have first Chern class positive. So these two examples have first Chern class positive. The second case, k is 2, the third case, k is 2, has first Chern class non-negative. And then k is 3 and higher have C1 indefinite. So in general, most of them that have indefinite first Chern class. We want to ask the question, well, what happens to the K-Ricci flow on this class of services?
Bigger than equal to 3?
Bigger than equal to 3. Before I talk about the K-Ricci flow, I want to say something about the K-Lacone. It turns out you can very easily describe the K-Lacone. That is, which cohomology classes admit Kähler metrics. And that's going to be important to us. When we do the Kähler-Ricci flow, we're not going to just... Well, it's important which Kähler class you start in. So I want to talk about the Kähler cone. And it turns out that every alpha... Let me call alpha Kähler class. Every Kähler class alpha can be written in the following form. It can be written, so let me explain my notation in a sec. So it can be written as B over K times the cohomology class of the curve D infinity. So I want to tell you in a second what these curves are. Minus A over K and then D zero, D naught. So K is just this natural number here. And A and B are numbers with B strictly bigger than A, and A strictly positive. So let me explain what these cohomology classes, D infinity and D naught, are. So there are natural curves sitting inside the manifold MK, and they correspond to certain sections of this bundle. So you can take two particular sections, a zero section and an infinity section. So let me write, D infinity is going to be the image of 0, 1 of the section 0, 1 in MK. So 0 is a section of... So that 0 is certainly a well-defined section of any line bundle. This is a section of h to the k. And then since this is a trivial line bundle, I can certainly take 1, and that's going to be a section of this trivial line bundle. And so you take that section, and that's going to define a curve sitting inside MK. So that we call D infinity, and this is a holomorphic curve. These places are going to be holomorphic curves. Okay, the next one is D naught, which we can define as in the following way. You just take the image of, rather than taking 0, 1, I do the opposite. I want to take 1, 0. But the problem is, of course, I can't take 1, 0, because 1 is not a well-defined section of the hyperbolic bundle. Indeed, H doesn't have any non-vanishing, any sections don't vanish anywhere. But what I can do is simply take sigma zero, where sigma is any holomorphic section. Any holomorphic section of H to the K. Now that's not going to be that's going to cause trouble because this is going to vanish at certain points. So I just simply take the closure of that image, and that closure will be independent of the choice of holomorphic section, because this is going to be zero except at a finite number of points, and the same with any other section. So this is independent of the choice of section. It's like the 1, 0. So these are my two holomorphic curves, and they define cohomology classes. So these are the cohomology classes, which are dual to these homology classes, these cycles. Or another way of thinking about it is take the line bundle associated to these divisors and take the first Chern class, and this gives you these are elements of H11, real 1-1 classes. So every Kähler class can be written in this way. So I want to consider now the Kähler-Ricci flow on these Herzenbruch surfaces, and we're interested in how that...
Is H11 generated by these two?
Yeah, and these two generate H11, yeah. And every Kähler class can be written exactly like this. So we consider the Kähler-Ricci flow, and I want to consider the unnormalized flow rather than any normalized flow. So unnormalized, which means I don't put the term lambda omega there, and that is ddt of omega is minus Ricci of omega, where we start with omega at t is 0 equal to some fixed metric omega naught. I'm going to make an assumption. Well, this is going to lie in some, say, alpha naught, which looks like b naught over k, d infinity, minus a naught over k, b naught. I want to make an assumption, which is a key assumption, which we haven't been able to remove in general. And the key assumption is that I want to assume that omega naught is invariant under a maximal compact subgroup of the automorphisms of the manifold M. That is, I want to assume it's invariant under this group, which I'll write as GK, and this turns out to be isomorphic to U2 over ZK. And I'll describe explicitly what this group is a little bit later. But the important thing is that this is a maximal compact subgroup. So I'll explain how that acts on. It's not obvious how that acts. I'll explain how that acts on the manifold. So these are subgroup of the automorphisms of the manifold M. So I want to make that assumption. Before I explain what happens to the flow, an easier question is: well, what happens to the Kähler classes? And this is something you can answer, in fact, pretty much immediately. So what happens to let me call it alpha t, which will be the Kähler class of omega t. So assume we have a solution, omega t to the Kähler-Ricci flow, and take the Kähler class to be alpha t, and let me define this to be bt over k, d infinity minus a t over k. So assume I have a solution and it's Kähler. What happens to these numbers b t and a t, which determine the Kähler class? Well, that's not, as I said, it's not able to figure out, and that's because the first Chern class is well known. The first Chern class of the manifold is given by k plus 2 over k d infinity plus k minus 2 over k d0. So that's just a computational well-known fact. But the Ricci curvature represents minus the first Chern class. So that tells me that ddt of alpha t is going to be minus this. And so that tells me exactly how AT and BT evolve. Because the first churn class is just minus the Vichy curvature of any Kähler metric. And so this simply, just take the cohomology class, it evolves by this. And so we see that BT looks like B naught minus K plus 2 times T, and AT evolves by A naught plus K minus 2 times T. So this is how these numbers BT and AT evolve. Okay, so finally, that's taking me some time to get to the result, but let me describe the main results on this. So as I said, this is joint work with Jansson. So let omega t solve the Kähler-Ricci flow on MK. So let me call this Kähler-Ricci flow with this assumption, of course. Then what we have is the following. So we have three cases. Two cases. The first case is the case k bigger than 2. And in this case, what happens is that the Kähler-Ricci flow, the solution exists on 0 capital T, where you can determine capital T, and that's very easy. It just exists until it stops being Kähler. So that just follows from these formulas. And that capital T is B0 minus A0 over K, over 2K. It exists on 0 T, where this is the maximal time. And we have the following. So I want to explain what happens to the Kähler-Ricci flow in the sense of Gromov-Hausdorff. So what happens is that the flow MK G of T converges in the Gromov-Hausdorff sense to P1 with the Fubini-Studi metric. And we have some multiple here, some constant here, AT, where AT is simply the constant given by this formula. Just plug in there, little t is capital T. So this converges in the sense of Gromov-Hausdorff to P1, and then this is GFS, is the Fubini-Studi metric. This is just the Fubini-Studi metric, the Kähler-Einstein metric on P1. So what that tells you is that what happens in this case A, whenever you have a Hertzberg surface where K is bigger than 2, the P1, the fiber, collapses. So what we see is that the fiber collapses, and you end up with the Fubini-Studi metric on the base P1. The second case is the case part B, and this is the case K equals 1. And as I said, I'm ignoring the case K is 0, which is the case of P1 cross P1. Now in the case K is 0, it turns out there are three different subcases. So let me explain what they are. So the first subcase, number one, is the case when and these subcases depend on the choice of initial Kähler metric, and the Kähler metric of initial Kähler metric, of course, is determined by these two numbers, B0 and A0, and so it depends on these two numbers, B0 and A0. The first case is the case where 3A0 is equal to B0. In this case, it turns out that the Kähler-Ricci flow exists until time capital T, which is now A0, A0, and what you have is that as T tends to capital T, so then as T tends to capital T, it actually just converges to a point. So we take the manifold M1 and the flow G of T, this converges in the Gromov-Hausdorff sense to a point. I'll explain that this actually is a rather simple case, although it's more interesting to know in this case what happens when you rescale the flow and you understand a little bit more what goes on. But let me just leave it at that for the moment. And then the other two cases are as follows. So number two case is when 3A naught is bigger than B naught. In this case, you get the same as A above. So in this case, you get exactly the same. You get that the fiber collapses and you shrink to the Fubini-Sturdy metric on the base. And I'll explain where these numbers come from. It's very, very simple. The third final case is when 3A naught is less than B naught. And in this case, something kind of interesting happens. That is the flow. So the flow, first of all, exists on 0, capital T, where T is equal to little a naught. And as T tends to capital T, the metric G of T converges to a metric which I call G of capital T smoothly on compact sets, on compact subsets of the manifold when you take away the curve D naught. And moreover, so let me say a little bit about this metric GT, which is not a canonical metric, but we can say the following. So if I write M GT, so if I write M and then DT as the metric completion, so you can complete this metric to get a metric space, this is the metric completion of M GT. So this is, I guess, M, you're taking M minus D naught and then GT. This is a smooth Kähler metric on M minus D naught. Take the metric completion, you get a metric space. So if this is the metric completion, then what we get is that MGT, so MGT, converges in the Gromov-Hausdorff sense, that is in the sense of metric spaces, to this completion. And we can say that this completion is homeomorphic to P2 and has finite amount of diameter. Okay, so those are the three cases. So let me say a little bit about what's happening in each of these cases. So what it comes down to is looking at the graphs. What happens in the case, let me just say very briefly since I don't have too much time, in the case A and B part 2, what happens is when you look at the evolution of these numbers, they meet in the middle. So this is AT, so A naught is always less than B naught. They meet in the middle. Whereas if you look at the case B part 1, they actually scale like this. This is AT, this is BT. And then if you look at the case, the final case, B part 3, what happens is that the A goes to 0, so you have this. So that's BT, and that's AT. And in the third case, what you get is something like this, where this is AT, and this is BT, and so the time to blow up happens here. So this actually happens something like that. What happens here is that the coefficient of D naught goes to zero, and that corresponds to D naught shrinking, and so this case corresponds to the contracting of D naught. Well, what is D naught? It turns out that D naught, this curve, is sitting inside a manifold. Well, as I mentioned before, this manifold in the case K equals 1 is P2 blown up at a point. And that means you replace a point by a rational curve, which is the exceptional curve, the exceptional divisor. What happens is that this is D naught is the exceptional divisor, and what happens is that contracts away. So the manifold becomes, at least morally speaking, becomes simpler. It starts off with P2 blown up at one point, it contracts to P2. the exceptional curve just disappears. What happens in these cases is that as B2 minus AT tends to zero, what happens is that the Kähler class degenerates and becomes the pullback of the Fubini-Studi metric from P1. So that becomes the limiting class. Okay, let me just say briefly before I move on, that this was conjectured by Feldman, Hillman and Knopf. So they conjectured a lot of this behavior. Let me move on briefly to say what happens in a higher dimensional case. Well, what you can do is you can, and probably I'm not going to have time to talk about the last two things. So let me just leave these and talk about the higher dimensional analog. In the case n strictly bigger than 2, what you can do is, well, let me just say bigger than equal to 2. What you can do is we can generalize this. So if you take m n k, define this to be, just take the projectivization of h k plus this trivial bundle CP1, where now this is now going to be a rank 2 bundle over p n minus 1. So these are just the hyperplane bundle over p n minus 1 now. This is a trivial bundle of a Pn minus 1. And then this now is going to be a P1 bundle over Pn minus 1. And then what happens is, in this general case, is as follows. We get that in the case part A, which corresponds to k bigger than 2, now becomes k bigger than n. In the k bigger than n case, what you get is that the manifold converges. Again, it collapses the fiber, and in the Gromov-Hausdorff sense, converges to Pn minus 1 with the Fubini-Studi metric. In the case B, where you now, there was the case k equals 1, now it's going to be the case where k is between 1 and n minus 1. And again, you get three subcases, and they are a naught n plus k equals b naught n minus k. Okay, let me just say one word about this case. In this case, what happens, and the same with this case here, is that the Kähler class is just a multiple of the first Chern class. And in that case, after you rescale it, you get the normalized Kähler-Ricci flow. And that's something that's been studied a lot on manifolds with C1 positive. And in particular, Perelman proved that on such a manifold, if you remain a multiple of the first Chern class, the diameter is bounded, which means that when you rescale back, the diameter shrinks to zero, and that immediately gives that you converge to a point. So that's what happens, and the same thing happens here. So it's actually, there's nothing to, we didn't prove anything here. This is already proved by Perelman. This converges to a point. Case two, is the case where this is bigger, and in this case you get the same as A. And then let me just end with the third case, which you basically get the same similar kind of thing as here in the third case, which is that A0 n plus k is strictly less than b naught n minus k. What you get is that the manifold nk g of t converges to some, you should get a similar thing, converges to some manifold which is a completion of the metric outside this d naught, but now this is going to be homeomorphic to pn, pn quotient out by zk, so this is an orbifold. And I'll finish there.
Okay, any questions?
So the calorie flow. So k equal to 2, it's C1 bigger than equal to 0, and k bigger than equal to 3, it's C1 indefinite, and calorie flow doesn't care which one is it.
Yeah. It doesn't seem to. Okay. It doesn't seem to care. Okay. It just collapses the P1
just
fiber.
Collapse.
Yeah.
So in the high-dimensional case, what is the column?
It's the same actually. You also have this d0 and d infinity, and you can define them exactly the same way, and they span the H11. Mm-hmm. So it's exactly the same, and it just all goes through in the same way.
Where did you use the assumption? Can you explain that?
Right, yeah, so I guess I didn't get to talking about the Calabi ansatz. The point is that when you talk about the manifold, you have this manifold, you have these two divisors. It turns out there's a very nice map. So let me just do it in two dimensions. There's a very nice map from C2 minus 0 to the manifold. There's a K to 1 map where you can describe the manifold from this to the manifold minus these two curves. This is a holomorphic K to 1 map, and the group action GK, which was U2 over ZK, this acts simply by C2. By U2 on C2. So the action of the group is simply the U2 action on C2, which means that you can regard your Kähler metric, if you could write your Kähler metric as simply dd bar of a function on C2 minus the origin, and the group action tells you that actually it only depends on the radial direction. Ah. So it only depends on one variable. So what you get is the function U, so you get gij bar will be like dIdj bar u, where u depends only on the sum x1 squared plus x2 squared. And then that helps with all of the estimates then.
Oh, okay. Then the partial derivative differential equation reduces to an ordinary one?
It's not an ODE because you still depend on time.
Oh, okay, yeah.
So it'll be a PDE in one space variable, yeah, and time. So that's what helps us out. It looks like this: log of u prime prime plus log of u prime. So if I use rho is the log of, if you do this, this is the Calabi ansatz. If I write rho is this log of the distance, this is distance squared. This is what you get. That's the flow. So it's PD in it. So this is a differentiation in the space. So it's a parabolic second order PD. And it's a nonlinear.
Do you have any feeling whether you would get similar results without this assumption?
Yeah, I mean, a lot of our estimates we prove without this. But in the end, to get this final result, we do need it. I would think that you probably could do a lot without this assumption, one would hope. Yeah, we're certainly thinking about that.
Any other questions? Okay, so let's thank the speaker again. Okay, we will go to, I forgot, a big start for early dinner. Maybe like 5:15.